The one thing I would absolutely not do is get an adjustable rate mortgage, because mortgage rates right now are so low that there's really only one way for them to go, and that's up. And you could have a very big problem if interest rates go up too quickly and too high, where the deal that today makes perfect sense and cash flow is fantastic, to all of a sudden you have negative cash flow. And that's going to be a problem. So I would make sure that whatever loan you get, make sure it's a fixed term for as long a period as possible.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm very excited to introduce our guest for the day, Anthony Chara. Anthony, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, Suja, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Really excited to hear about what you have been working on. You have been investing in real estate since 1993. He first started in single family homes and made the jump to multifamily in 2004, which is a really long time to have been investing in multifamily. It means you're a seasoned vet. And yeah, Anthony has owned over 2,000 units since then and currently has 320 units. So would love to hear about how and why you got started in real estate investing in the first place, if you don't mind starting us off with that, Anthony.
Not a problem, Suja. So I started investing, my wife and I started investing back in 93. We started looking into it in 1991 because we were both kind of tired of our jobs and we kept hearing stories about people who had made a lot of money in real estate. And I think the thing that kind of put us over the edge is we read an article and somebody stated that something like 86 to 87% of all current millionaires either made their money or held most of their money in real estate. So we figured, well, why reinvent the wheel? Let's go out and learn what we're missing. As a matter of fact, it was kind of funny because my family had no intention of doing real estate investing at all. As a matter of fact, my parents helped my sister buy a townhouse in Southern California. And we went out one weekend and we all cleaned it up and painted all the rooms and got it all ready for them. And then 6 months later, after they moved in, they announced that they were getting a divorce. And pretty much the very next day, my parents put a for sale sign in the yard because they had decided that they were not going to be landlords because of all the bad stories that they heard. So that delayed my entrance into the program. But again, from just reading and talking to other people, one of the things that we learned was that why are we listening to people who have never done it? My parents had always either been renters or owned their own home, and they owned their own home when I was born, but they had never been a landlord.
Yeah.
So why not go out and learn from people who had done it? So that's what we started to do in 91 and then started actually investing in 93.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot, I think, to overcome that initial barrier about, is this going to work for me or how is it going to work? And, you know, how did you actually go ahead and overcome that that barrier? I mean, did you seek out educational events? I mean, it was a totally different world back then. So really curious to see how you got started back then.
Yeah, we did. So I actually had a book years ago called Wealth Without Risk from a gentleman named Charles Givens, who's passed on. And there's actually a late night infomercial under the same name now called Wealth Without Risk, but it was a completely different concept. The book was about doing little things to increase your wealth, checking your property insurance and your car insurance every single year to see if you can get better rates, better terms, better coverage, things like that. Plus, it talked about credit cards and changing credit cards and finding something with a lower interest rate. And there was probably 30 or 40 different little topics in there. In the very back of the book, it had a little card that said, if you want to learn about real estate investing, fill out the card. So I did, filled it out, sent it in. And then my wife and I were invited to a 4-day boot camp that was put on by the Charles Givens organization. And that's what basically opened our eyes in 1991 to the fact that there was other ways that you could make money out there passively by investing in real estate. So that's how we started learning, was by getting the education and going to that 4-day class and then looking for properties from that point forward.
Awesome. Okay. So I know you've been doing multifamily for a long time and I want to get to that soon, but can you just give us an idea of where you started buying single family houses and also how?
Yeah. So back then in 93 is when we made our venture into passive real estate investing with single family homes. My wife and I had been looking for another home to move into because we didn't really like the neighborhood we were in, and we were planning on filling up the house with kids and we didn't have enough room. So we started looking. It took us about a year and a half or 2 years to find the home that as soon as we both saw it, we looked at each other and had to pinch each other because it's like, oh my God, we finally found it. And so we turned our first house into a rental. That's how we stepped into it. So we qualified because we both had good jobs. We qualified for the second house, moved out of the first one, turned it into a rental property and started managing it and then going from there. And then every couple of years, all we knew to do at that point was to buy a house, turn it into a rental, buy a house, turn it into a rental. We didn't know anything else about doing fix and flips or apartments or wholesaling deals or anything like that. So our first one was in Colorado. And then as we started to grow, we ended up getting more in Colorado. We started doing creative investing. We learned that from Robert Allen, another guru out there in the market. We learned how to actually literally get people to hand you the keys to their house and walk away. So we did that 4 times. So that also added to our rental portfolio. And so we ended up with about 9 or 10 single family homes and condos between Colorado. We bought a couple down in Las Vegas. We bought one in Arizona. We bought a couple down in Florida.
Okay, very cool. Yeah, I'm sure there's just so much there. I do want to kind of shift now to like, why did you end up switching to multifamily?
We switched to multifamily because we got tired of doing the onesie, one here, one there. And I also met another partner, a gentleman named George Antone, which a lot of your listeners have probably heard of. And he and I met at another event and started chatting about what we were doing. And it was also when real estate, the market was really, really hot before the Great Recession. This was back in like 2003, 2004. And we figured that we both had an interest in multifamily investing and also had decided that there was more ways to make money. So back using Robert Allen's term, multiple streams of income, we decided that rather than just have our jobs, actually by then I didn't even have a job. I quit my last corporate job way back in 1997, but we wanted additional income, additional money coming in. And we decided that we were going to start buying multifamily properties. As a matter of fact, George already had a couple. And so part of that was putting together a class to teach people how to invest in multifamily property based on George's experience, and then using that class as almost like a platform to educate other people and then possibly find other investors to come in and join with us, because we knew that we weren't going to get wealthy buying one single family home at a time and making $100 or $200 a month in cash flow. That just wasn't going to cut it. Eventually, our own pockets were going to run dry. And that's not good, because you want to make sure that you have enough resources so if something does go sideways, and occasionally it will, that you're not all of a sudden filing bankruptcy or going into foreclosure on some of these properties.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So when you got tired of doing onesies and then you started to teach about it at the same time, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, cool. And so are you and George, do you teach George Anton, do you teach classes together? Is this your company that you run together?
Well, it used to be one that we ran together, but then George backed out way back in about 2010, 2011, just because he didn't want to keep doing all the travel, because that's one of the things that you run into with some of the classes we teach. Since we teach them nationwide, we were on airplanes a couple times a month going around to different real estate investor groups around the country to teach strategies on how to invest in multifamily. So we started it together back in 04, 05, somewhere in there, and started teaching people based on George's experience with what he already owned and then buying properties. And our first one we partnered in was 344-unit condo conversion development that were apartments that were going to be converted to condos. Then we invested in a 98-unit property down in Shreveport, Louisiana, and it just kind of went from there. And then George, again, got tired of all the travel, so he decided to back out. So I've been running it pretty much myself since 2011, so about 10 years now.
Okay, great. And yeah, I would love to just hear, you know, in a nutshell, what it is that, I know you teach people about how to invest and whatnot, but can you just summarize like what is your area of expertise in terms of the education that you guys provide?
Sure. All the education that I provide, or most of it, revolves around apartment investing, multifamily investing, 5 units and up. And we also teach not only some of the strategies you learn in single family homes also translate to multifamily, doing things like subject twos, wrap mortgages, lease options. It's all applicable to apartments as well.
Awesome. Love it. Okay, great. Well, I'd love to hear, what tips you have on analyzing deals, or for people who are out there kind of thinking about, I want to get into multifamily. I mean, obviously, you can teach an entire class on this, but where are some places that people could start in terms of analyzing deals and where to invest their money?
Great question, Suja. So the first thing people need to figure out, though, or do, is you do need to get educated. Whether it's my course or somebody else's course or a book, you need to understand the difference between investing in single family homes and investing in apartment complexes. So keep in mind that an apartment complex is a multifamily, but not all multifamilies are apartment complexes. Obviously, a duplex, a triplex, and a fourplex are multifamily properties, but they're valued differently than an apartment complex, which is 5 units and up. The reason there's the distinction of 5 units and up is because 4 units and less is it's a personal loan. You're going to be signing on the loan. It's going to go in your name and it's going to be attached to your credit report, which means it's going to affect your credit and it's going to make your score go up or down depending on how you handle your payments. 5 units and up is considered a commercial loan. So 5 units and up should not be going on your credit report. Sometimes it accidentally ends up there, but it shouldn't be as long as you work with the right lenders. So as far as analyzing the deals, 4 units and less, you're going to analyze those based on comparables. And if you've bought, or any of your listeners have bought, a single family home before, they know that they apply for the loan with the bank. And basically you fill out the application. And on the application, you basically prove to the bank that you don't need their money, and then they will loan you money. That's really what it is. You're going to prove to them that you don't need the money at all, but you prove that and then they loan you money because they want to make sure they get their money back. And then once your application is approved, then they go out and they do an appraisal on the property that you have under contract. And they compare it to other similar properties in the market to see what they sold for, whether they have a pool or no pool, air conditioning, no air conditioning, how many bedrooms, square footage, right? They compare all that stuff. With apartment buildings, they can do the same thing, but the first thing that they usually do, there's actually 3 ways they can value an apartment building or commercial property. The first way is through what's called the income approach. So the big thing that your listeners need to understand is they need to get educated on what is the income approach. It's basically how much money does that property generate? How much money am I putting out of my pocket or out of the income that's being generated to pay for the daily maintenance? So taking care of all the maintenance and repairs and everything like that, and then what's left over. And if you buy it at the right price and you make enough income, and then once you pay all your operating expenses off, have enough money left over to then pay a mortgage payment to the bank, then the bank will look at that and say, okay, the property's at the right value, we will give you a loan. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. Obviously, I don't know how much people picked up on it, but that's the main way to value a commercial property is through the income that it generates. They also use the comparable approach, just like single family homes. And the third way that they value commercial property is through what's called replacement cost, which is, example, your insurance policy, right? If the place burns to the ground, what's it going to cost to rebuild that property from the ground up?
Yeah, for sure. So, and thanks for that overview. I mean, I think that's very helpful for people who are, new to this space. Isn't there someone who still has to sign on the loan, even though, the bank isn't requiring that you necessarily have that income and don't need their money? Can you walk us through, how to solve that problem?
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, the bank is still going to require someone to sign on the loan as the guarantor. That may or may not be you. As a matter of fact, in all the years that I've been buying multifamily properties or apartment properties, I've only signed on one loan, and that was only for about 2 years. And we just, matter of fact, about a little under a year ago, we refinanced it. And when we refinanced it, I didn't have to sign on the new loan. So you do have to have a credit partner or credit partners that meet the criteria of the bank in order to get the loan, because someone still has to guarantee it. And some of your listeners have probably heard of things called non-recourse loans. And they're under the misnomer that a non-recourse loan means that if the deal goes sideways and you lose money and you have to basically turn the property back over to the bank, that you just hand them the keys and walk away. That is not true. In most cases, even though it's a non-recourse loan, you still have to follow the bank's guidelines. And if you don't follow the bank's guidelines, they will pierce through those exceptions that you agreed to, and they will come after you. And it's still a recourse loan, meaning they can come after you, your personal assets, your house, anything else that you added to your application when you filled it out.
What are some of those guidelines that, you know, maybe you've come across that people are not following?
Well, so let me quickly wrap up this other question, the original question. So as far as getting a loan, so what you need to do, some basic guidelines are you or whoever's going to be signing as the guarantor has to have a net worth equal to or greater than the loan balance. So if you're buying $1 million property and you're getting a 75% LTV loan or $750,000 loan, you and or your partners have to have a combined net worth of at least $750,000. That's one of the main things that they look at. And of course, they may look at your experience and things like that, but that's a couple little things that'll get you started. As far as the guidelines that the bank can punch through, these are actually called bad boy clauses or carve-outs. So even though it's a non-recourse loan, and theoretically people think, oh, you can't come after me, there's anywhere from 6 to 8 to 10 to 12 different things that you're going to be signing on as part of these carve-outs. I'll give you the three main ones. One of the main ones is obviously you're not going to commit fraud. That's pretty easy to understand. And one of the things that the bank considers fraud is you make a distribution to yourself or your investors, and then shortly thereafter, you don't have enough money to pay the mortgage, and you put your hands up and go, oh, sorry, I don't have any more money, so here's the keys back. The bank knows in a lot of cases that you did do a distribution because a lot of the banks are going to require that you have your working account at their bank and they can see the checks that you've written and where the money went. So they're going to go to you and say, no, you had the money, you just distributed it. Go back to yourself and your investors, get that money and come back and make the payment. If you don't do that, they would then consider that fraud. And then now your non-recourse loan becomes recourse.
Is it fraudulent to distribute money and not be able to get it back? Is that something that's like generally true across the board? I mean, don't we sign legal documents that allow us to make distributions?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yes, you're absolutely allowed to make distributions, but if you make a distribution, let's say 2 months ago, and now 3 months later, you can't make the monthly mortgage payment, the bank's going to know that. Now, you can't necessarily go back to your investors and say, you have to give me the money back, because some of them might have already spent it.
Yeah.
But you have to do what you can do to get that money back. And if the bank feels like you're not doing what you need to do, or they don't care, because they don't have to care. You broke their guideline. They can see that you did a distribution and now 3 months later, you're claiming that you're broke. Well, that's not the case because you just had a bunch of money and distributed it. So go back to your investors.
Okay.
So that's a problem.
Yeah.
All right. The second thing is you agree to maintain the property to the bank standards because that's actually their asset until you pay off the loan. So they're going to come out, they're going to walk the property every 1 to 2 years, and they're going to come up with a list of things that you need to do to the property to maintain the property. Sometimes you'll see where sidewalks are going like this because something happens, a tree root or water or something like that, and this becomes a trip hazard. So what happens is the bank says, no, you need to fix this. So whether you just grind this part down so that it's nice and flat, or you completely jackhammer out this one and then put in more concrete to make it a nice level sidewalk, they're going to tell you to do that. They'll tell you to replace or repair roofs, rain gutters, siding, parking lots, interiors to the units, hot water systems, anything that they want, they'll tell you you need to fix those things. And if you don't fix it within a reasonable amount of time, then guess what? Your non-recourse loan just became a recourse loan because you're not taking care of their asset the way that they told you to.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
The last one is your insurance. You need to maintain adequate insurance. If the insurance ever lapses and then you have a claim, guess what? You need to fix it on your own dime. And if you don't, the bank comes after you because they just turned your non-recourse loan into a recourse loan. You also have to make sure that if you do have an insurance and a valid claim, that you have to show the bank that you took the money from that claim and put it back into the property to actually fix the property the way that you agreed to fix it. Because if you don't, then again, you just took your non-recourse loan and made it a recourse loan.
Okay. Good to know. I didn't realize that there were all these ways that you a non-recourse loan could become a recourse loan. So thanks for going over that.
You bet. Yeah. And like I said, that's only just maybe the top three. There's probably 8 to 10 to 12 things that you're going to be signing. So before you sign your loan documents, make sure you read it. Make sure you understand it. If you don't understand it, take it to your attorney. Take it to somebody that understands it so they can explain to you exactly what you're signing and agreeing to.
For sure. For sure. Very helpful. Okay. Thanks so much, Anthony, for going over, you know, how a non-recourse loan could become a recourse loan. I mean, obviously you and I both help people invest passively in real estate. Can you talk about the difference between liability when you're passively investing versus actively investing?
Yeah, great question. So first off, yeah, we talked about, like you said, turning a non-recourse loan into recourse. Well, passive investors, if they are what are called LPs or limited partners, they're limited to only what they invest in that particular deal, which means the only people that are liable are whoever signs on the loan as the credit partners. So if you have, matter of fact, we just finished a deal and we have there's 36 total investors. Well, 33 of us are what we would call non-passive investors, three of us are non-passive, 33 are passive, which means the 33 that are passive, if they invested $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 or more, that's it for their liability, which means if the bank decides that we screwed up and they want to come after us, they can only come after us. They can only come after who signed on the loan application as the guarantor for the loan and all the closing documents. All of the limited partners who just wanted that passive income, that's it. They're off the hook. So the bank can't come after them. There's not going to be any lawsuits against them. The only thing they could potentially lose is whatever the investment is that they put into the deal in the first place.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's such an important point when it comes to passive investing is that your liability is limited, right? Like if you want to get involved in real estate and purchase single family homes or purchase small apartment buildings all on your own, you can do that. And at the same time, you're subject to the liability that comes with either, you know, getting sued for something that happens on your property or the property not being able to perform as it needs to. So having your liability limited is just, you know, it should not be underestimated in terms of a benefit of passive investing. What would you say, you know, we were originally talking about or previously talking about a loan being signed on by a guarantor. Just to give the listeners an idea, what would you say is like a reasonable compensation for someone who's going to be signing on the loan?
Ooh, well, that's actually a question I get a lot. And quite frankly, I try to avoid the answer because literally what I do is when I go to my credit partners, the people that are going to be signing on the loan, I actually don't tell them what I'm going to give them. I mean, I know based on deconstructing the deal and figuring out what's available for the money partners, what's available for the person that found the loan, which is usually, or found the deal, which is usually me, or anybody else that needs to be involved in the deal, like an experienced partner, I kind of know what's available for a credit partner as far as the piece of the deal, but I don't tell them that. What I do is I show them all the documentation. I show them the analysis that we've done on the property. I tell them how much we need as far as a loan balance. And then I send that out to about 4 or 5 or 6 different people that I think would be interested in it. And I say, hey, here's a deal that we're working on. We're looking for a loan guarantor or slash credit partner slash sponsor. There's all kinds of different names that people give them. Number one, are you interested? And number two, if the answer is yes, what do you want? So I let them set the limits. I let them come back to me and tell me how much they want in order to be the credit partner. And I've literally had people tell me anywhere from 2% of the deal to 25% of the deal. Obviously, I'm not going to start with the people at 25. I'm going to go start with the people that want 2%. And then the only other thing that I do beyond that is I start at the people at the lower end, but then I actually interview them, because just because they only want 2% doesn't mean it's going to be a good fit. I found that out the hard way. I actually had a partner who was using his wealth to be the guarantor on several different projects that we did together. Matter of fact, three of them. And I found out the hard way that he, not only did he want to be the credit partner and he was okay with that, but then he also said, well, because I'm going to be the credit partner and it's my credit that's on the line, I'm going to run the project. And when I first started up, this was way back in 2006, 2007, when I met him, I figured, well, that seems fairly reasonable. He's putting $4, $5, $6 million of his net worth online. He might as well be the person running the project. And he also had experience too. It wasn't like he just came out of left field. He actually owned 8 apartment buildings before I met him. And I figured, okay, this would be a good fit. He wants to be the credit partner. He's going to be what's called the asset manager and take care of everything. No problem. Well, I also found out that he doesn't listen to anybody except himself, which is a problem. So I'm seeing issues with the financial statements. I'm seeing issues with the condition of the property. I'm bringing this stuff up. He doesn't care and he doesn't listen. We ended up losing one of the properties because he wouldn't listen. It was foreclosed on because he wouldn't listen and take care of it. So yeah. And so now what I do is I do start with people that are on the lower end, but then one of the questions I ask them is, are you going to be okay with me or someone I pick to run the project as the asset manager? And if the answer is no, I move on. And if the next person wants 5%, I go from 2% to 5%. And again, I know ahead of time, I know how much I can give out and still have a profitable deal for all of our investors. So I'm going to go to the next one at 5%. I'm going to ask them the same questions. How would they run the deal? Are they okay if this happens? Are they okay if that happens? Are they okay with me or somebody that I know running the project? And they're going to be is a silent partner. If they say yes, great, let's go.
Yeah, totally. For sure. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, sometimes lessons do need to be learned. You know, they just are learned the hard way. And that's just part of doing this business. So thanks for sharing that experience. I'd love to hear from you, Anthony. Also, you know, you've been around a long time. What was the Great Recession like for you? And, you know, were there any challenges with that? I mean, I'm sure there was something that came up. And, you know, what learnings can you share?
Yeah, the Great Recession. That was wonderful. So again, we learned through our mistakes. So some of the mistakes that I made back then was I started listening to the gurus, and the gurus were talking about how much real estate was going up every year. There were a couple areas like Florida and Nevada where real estate was going up 15, 20, 25% a year in value. And so I'm thinking, wow, this is great. And they're like, oh yeah, you buy it, you hold it for 6 or 12 months, and then you sell it, you make a killing, you move that money into the next project, and you just keep on going. Well, we listened to the gurus and we started buying single family homes as rentals. And what we didn't take into consideration were a couple of things. Well, what if the market went down? What was currently going on with rental rates and things like that? And what was going on with interest rates? And one of the mistakes we made back then was getting into an adjustable rate mortgage. So some of the properties we started out with, we had maybe $100 a month in passive income, maybe minus $100 a month in passive income. But, you know, minus $100 a month didn't really mean a whole lot to me back then, because I was still making money through other real estate investments and started doing the apartments, and that was starting to pick up. So I wasn't real concerned about it. My wife still had a really good paying job. So $100 a month here or there wasn't a big deal. We ended up with 10 properties, and we also had 2 pieces of land. Well, the 2 pieces of land alone were $5,000 a month in payments, and land doesn't generate income at all unless it's farmland. And this wasn't farmland. These were roughly 1-acre parcels. One was in Tennessee, one was in North Carolina. And because of how, you know, real estate was just doing this. And of course, real estate only goes up like this. So we bought the properties, these acreages, with the idea that in about a year, we were just going to flip them and sell them for a really nice profit. Well, we bought, and what happened to the market, right? It was going like this, then all of a sudden it did this and started going down. And we ended up losing both of those 2 pieces of land, because we just decided to let the bank have them back, because that was $5,000 a month in negative cash flow. The other thing that happened during the course of the Great Recession is rental rates started going down. And so our $100 a month in cash flow was now gone, or our minus $100 a month in cash flow was now minus $200 or minus $300 because we couldn't rent the units for the same price. On top of that, we had a couple of adjustable rate mortgages. So now all of a sudden the mortgages, the interest rate went up. So the payment went up and the rent's going down. So we went from about roughly $1,000 a month in negative cash flow to adding these two pieces of land. And now we're at $6,000 a month in negative cash flow to our rates and everything adjusting. And now all of a sudden we're $10,000 a month in negative cash flow. That was extremely painful. Yeah. So what we ended up doing is, again, we just let the two pieces of land go. And so that got rid of $5,000 right there off the top. Fortunately, we still had money coming in from the apartments and we still had money coming in from the training and my wife still had her job. But the $10,000 a month was literally just sucking our bank account. You could actually hear, we could hear our bank sending us emails and the bank account, the emails from the bank account were... as our reserves and our savings were just dwindling faster than we could put more money back into them. And that's why we made the decision just to let the two pieces of land go. We had to stop the bleeding. So we still had at the time, we still had all of our other single family rentals. Since then, we've only sold one. We gave one back to one of our buyers or sellers. The lady actually had moved out of town, came back and wanted her to see if she could get her house back. And it was one of those adjustable rate mortgages that I screwed up on and I forgot to check on the mortgage. I mean, because she literally handed me the keys to her property and walked away. And I was thinking about contacting her and saying, you want your house back? Because again, it was just sucking us dry at the same time as those other two pieces of land. That one was probably a good $400-$600 a month in negative cash flow. And so out of the blue, right, you put that out there to the universe, I need to do something with this property. And all of a sudden the previous owner calls up and says, hey, we're moving back to Colorado. Can we get our house back? And I said, yes, you can.
Wow.
Yeah. So gave her house back. And then last July or August, whenever it was, we sold one of our one and only property in Arizona, single family home in Arizona. So we still have the rest of them. They're still doing extremely well. Rental rates have gone back up. We've refinanced all of them. So the mortgage payments have dropped considerably. So now we got a lot of passive income coming in.
Totally. So having been through that and, you know, with where we are at the market right now, obviously pricing is going through the roof. What advice would you give to people who are, you know, what are you not going to do this time? And what would you do if you were in the same position as before?
The one thing I would absolutely not do is get an adjustable rate mortgage, because mortgage rates right now are so low that there's really only one way for them to go, and that's up. And you could have a very big problem if interest rates go up too quickly and too high, where the deal that today makes perfect sense and cash flow is fantastic to all of a sudden you have negative cash flow. And that's going to be a problem. So I would make sure that whatever loan you get, make sure it's a fixed term for as long of a period as possible. That's the other thing that I hear from people is like, oh, I'm going to get a 15-year mortgage because then I've got it paid off in 15 years. Then I don't have to worry about it any year, ever again. You may never get to 15 years. So I tell people, I tell all my students to get the longest amortization period possible. If you get a 30-year mortgage, you can always choose to pay it off in 15 years if things are going great. But if you get a 15-year note, you can't choose to pay it off in 30. You can't skip a payment.
Right.
And when I talk to people and they say, well, yeah, I want to pay it off faster because then I won't have to worry about it. It's like, but it's still 15 years. You're still making the same monthly mortgage payment every single month for 15 years. You're not going to be able to do anything extra until the 15 years is up. And most people don't hold their properties for 15 years anyway. And you're not paying off the mortgage either. Your renters are. So why not get the longest loan term possible? Again, if things are going well, you can throw more money at the mortgage and pay it down faster, but your residents are paying it off anyhow. So that's one of the things that I've learned is not to get an adjustable rate mortgage, get the longest loan term possible, get it locked in for as long as possible.
For sure. Really good advice. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Anthony. You've shared just a ton of great information and stories, et cetera. Learned so much. Will you please share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and anything else you want to share?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. So you could reach out to me and learn more about me at successclasses.com. That is plural, successclasses.com. You can also email me, anthony@successclasses.com.
Awesome. Well, definitely check out Anthony's stuff. Clearly has a wealth of experience teaching people about how to actually, you know, make their money work for them, invest in real estate, invest in multifamily, et cetera. Thank you so much, Anthony, for coming on the show. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks, Suju. It was fun.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.